Thank you for attending session 274, titled The Transcendent Power of the Between. Before we talk, we ask that your cell phones are turned off, and that those attending will please be respectful and attentive. It's the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of this session, following the remarks of the speakers. Those who cannot abide by the regulations should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. That's very serious. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk. Consider also purchasing Skull Candy official headphones, customized just for Sunstone. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so that we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. That was a mouthful. My name is Chelsea Barnard Archibald. I am the moderator for this session. Our first speaker, well, we'll talk about the abstract first. Susan Rothbaum argues that church leave-takers have a foot in each world, but are at home in neither. This experience of being between two worlds can be both depressing and elating, painful and productive. Thomas McConkie and Gina Colvin will explore this space between two worlds, where new identities, attachments, and ways of understanding the self, God, and the world are worked out. They will explore the productivity of the liminal space and provide a theoretical framework from which to apprehend spiritual transitions as fruitful, grounding, and personally and socially transformative. First, we will hear from Thomas McConkie. He is the author of Navigating Mormon Faith Crises. Do you want to go first, Gina?
Well, it's kind of, we're just sort of going in and
okay,
out.
Okay, this is just what I'm reading.
Okay, you just
so, women first. Gina Colvin is a New Zealander. How do I say?
Is it?
Yeah.
That I mean? Oh, okay.
I mean, you could do your own intro if you wanted.
Oh, no, go ahead. Sorry. I'm trying to control this.
She is a multi-generational lifetime Mormon. She is a professor at the University of Canterbury with an emphasis on cultural and colonial studies. She will be speaking first, followed by Thomas McConkie, who is the author of Navigating Mormon Faith Crisis. He is faculty in Pacific Integral, where he researches adult development and supports individuals and collectives in activating their growth through embodied practice. Gina.
Actually, if I could say something, Chelsea. Can everybody hear me? I might have to. Okay. Can everybody hear me?
Can everybody see him? Is it easier if we stand there or stand up here? We stay down?
Yeah.
I've got people.
I'm
okay.
People
please raise your hand
us.
If we go there.
Oh.
Okay.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. Or maybe if we come a little closer this way and stay down. Maybe we could just shove over.
What about just kind of squatting? Yeah.
Nice. We're going to be in the between.
Here, yeah. We'll just let this whole process be emergent in the spirit of liminality. We're already in the liminal. That's what happens when you invoke the liminal. I just wanted to say as we're starting out that I was just prepping, like I was just kind of sitting and going over some notes down the hall the last hour, and I thought, what on earth were we thinking when we decided to do a panel on the liminal? What does that even mean? And then I realized, like, I'm already in the liminal space. I don't know where I am. I don't know how I got there. I don't know what's coming next. You feel that? Back to you, Gina.
And I have to point out that this is a way that we work, and I'm like, okay, what are the bullet points? How are we going to do that? How long is it going to take? And he's like, we'll just see what comes up. And I'm in the liminal. But what we thought we would do is just set some groundwork and talk a little bit to begin with about what liminality is and how we understand it. And we understand it we take the two different parts of liminality. The social part of liminality I will talk about and theorize, and Thomas will talk about the individual in threshold space. But we'll be going backwards and forwards. And I think we wanted to say, just prepare you that this may be a little different. In terms of a workshop, it won't just be us standing up, talking, and then getting Q&A. There'll be little surprises along the way. I don't know what those surprises are because I'm in the liminal space and I'm working with Thomas McConkie.
Wait, quick question.
Yes.
Can you spell liminal?
I can define liminal.
I feel like a spelling bee judge over here.
L-I-M-I-N-A-L.
That is correct, Gina Colvin.
Okay, so let's just talk about liminality for a moment. And I'm going to talk about it as a sociologist and as an anthropologist.
Mike.
It felt really loud to me. Okay, is that better?
Yes.
Is that better?
Yes.
All right. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the theory of liminality in terms of the broader sense of community that evolves in threshold spaces, and Thomas will do what he does and talks about individual, because like he's kind of Zen Buddhist, they sit kind of on mountaintops alone, and while he's been doing that, I've been kind of among the throng in Mormonism, so
I resent that.
Okay, let me begin. 2 years ago, I wrote in my journal, number one, how attached am I to my religion? Number two, do I want to hold the temple as a place of sanctification? Three, if I hung around in the church, would I be willing to serve? And if I did, in what capacity would I be willing? Number four, who am I in this place? And can I bring my whole self to it? And what do I risk in doing so? And if I choose not to believe in every truth claim, does that still make me a Mormon? And how do I deal with the reality, the very pressing reality that religion is always, always destined to fail us and its own highest aspirations? And then I followed up with the statement, and I was kind of pleased to see it sitting there. I said, while some powerful people might have impoverished inner lives in this new space of Mormon becoming, we are growing our lives defiantly, creatively, and beautifully. Now, I think there are two paradoxes there, twin paradoxes that I was sensing intuitively. This questioning and doubting self often butts up against this new self that's emerging. What I couldn't see at the time was how interconnected they are. The death of one self always gives rise to a new self. So the crisis of my religious and spiritual self was making way organically for a growing power, to an outbreak of new feeling. It was refreshing my understanding. As painful as it was, that's what it was doing. And I was experiencing a different orientation in my relationship with the divine. The interesting thing about this dynamic, this dualism of death and rebirth in the realm of the self, is ubiquitous. In other words, what I captured in my journal, albeit unconsciously, was a social and a personal drama or a phenomenon that's not unique in human experience. It's not even unique in the Mormon community. Something often happens across time, across cultures, it's invariant, it always happens, that a moment that propels folks out of complete fidelity to the way that they had understood their lives before. And in Mormonism, once the breaches in the church structures are witnessed, it seems that everything that once looked truthful and coherent is now strewn with cracks and fissures, whether theologically or socially
or culturally or doctrinally, where once one took comfort in the certainty and coherence offered by the church, it's not difficult to do so. And it's not difficult to understand that we are letting go of something when we rise to a new self. There's this myth of certainty that gets cracked and the self begins to change. This reshaping of the self then leads to this negotiated exile, and we all do it in different ways. And most of us flee to the community perimeters. This is a threshold space. This is us fleeing, where once beloved and trusted relationships are left behind. Some do this quietly, others do this dramatically. This leave-taking, however enacted, is soon noticed by loved ones, and a deep sense of betrayal is often felt by spouses or family members who naturally panic at what it means to have this newly oriented and often someone who is experienced as menacing person in their lives. And then the person finds borderland communities where they're welcomed, and they find themselves associating now with like-minded people where they experience new friendships, powerful dialogue, and meaning, and new meaning creations. And I'm going to hand it now over to Thomas, who's going to talk about threshold spaces from his tradition.
Cool. Okay, I'll just hunch over a little bit. Can everybody hear me? Okay, thank you for that beautiful entree, Gina. So there's a lot to say about this. I want to offer three really basic concepts to illustrate how we think about the liminal in terms of human development, in terms of faith crisis, in terms of coming into a whole new identity, as Gina was pointing to. There are three really simple words. They might even be worth writing down if you have a pen, but they're just three words, so you can remember them too. Fusion. The next one is multisyllabic. It's differentiation. Third word is integration. Fusion, differentiation, integration. So I want to just teach these concepts by way of an analogy, by way of a metaphor, so you can really kind of locate the concepts in your own life, right? We can learn about concepts up on the whiteboard, or we can learn about the territory of who we are and what we've experienced. I prefer the latter when it comes to adult learning. So when we talk about fusion, differentiation, integration, a metaphor I like to use is the child who moves into adolescence, right? So the fusion phase represents when we're in a place in our identity where we're just okay. We're comfortable, we're ensconced, we're enmeshed. We don't have any particular problems or quarrels with the world around us. The world is as it should be. Things feel just fine, right? So it's a kind of stasis when we're in fusion, right? All of us in one way or another have this activity present in our lives right now. We're fused with something. It might be with a spouse. It might be with our family, with the community. Fusion is happening all the time. But in a Mormon context, you can think back to a time. It might be now. I'm guessing it's probably not now if you're at a Sunstone Symposium. But you can think back to a time where it felt like absolutely nothing was wrong with your life, your identity in the church. Nothing had to change at all, right? So just notice that that's really alive and it's real for all of us. The metaphor of the pre-adolescent is that your family is your world before you hit adolescence, right? That's where you get your identity. That's how you learn to be somebody in the world, right? You're in a family, you're nested, you're enmeshed, right? And then something really significant happens. If healthy growth occurs, we move into a differentiation process. So this early adolescent, that manifests as, oh, my mom and dad aren't as cool as I thought they were, right? I don't want to be around them like I used to want to, right? I want to be around my friends. I want to dress differently. I talk differently. You know, family traditions are burdensome, and I don't want to go to I don't know, Mount Rushmore this summer. I'd rather stay back and hang out with my friends. Right? We're different than we used to be. We've taken a step back, as Gina pointed to. We're differentiating from an old identity, right? And I'm guessing that all of us in some way in this room have had an experience of differentiating from our native culture, where all of a sudden we were looking at something objectively and noticing that it doesn't hold us in the same way it used to. Whereas we had the experience of being in the womb before and everything was just right down to the temperature. And then all of a sudden, you're starting to feel the jagged edges. You're not as comfortable in this space as you used to be. This is liminal space. The differentiation is liminality. It's uncomfortable. We're not who we used to be. And we haven't become who we're becoming yet. And a lot of times we do anything to rid ourselves of the tension, to solve this tension, right? What comes after the differentiation phase? We'll have time to really process this together doing some different exercises, but I'm just giving you a little bit of the map right now. What happens after differentiation? Hello, Bill.
How are
you? Good to see you.
We were down listening to Deborah Stuffer, so...
Yeah, I don't know if that's a compliment to me or an insult to Denver, but I appreciate it. So after the differentiation, if we're able to negotiate this daunting liminality where we have lost our old identity, we've negotiated this death and we're reborn into some kind of new being, we look back on who we once were, right? The mature adolescent looks back and says, you know what, I can actually be my own person and I still love my family. That intense irritation we felt in family life during the differentiation phase, all of a sudden that cools off and it matures into an appreciation of a different aspect, a different layer of self that we need a distance from. We had to die to in order to grow into something new. And then when we integrate from a higher principle. We integrate the family from a new self. So there's a new degree of freedom. There's a new degree of creativity. There's a new degree of autonomy, right? So we fuse with our circumstances. And then circumstances feel really uncomfortable, and they're not adequate to meet our needs in life anymore. And that's when we differentiate. And once we've differentiated, if we can really face the issues that come up with courage and honesty, it leads into an integration where we're born into something totally new. Everyone following so far? I'm just setting up the territory here so we can dive in together. Gina, can you comment here? Cool, thank you.
Okay, I'm coming up with my notes. He's coming up with his head. Okay. So I'd like to follow on from Thomas by saying how utterly and completely normal this is. Whatever we're experiencing that throws us out into liminal space, into threshold spaces, is absolutely predictable, it's unsurprising. And this theatre of change and transformation isn't unique to Mormonism, as I said before. It's a part of the human condition. In fact, it's unintuitive to contain people within a way of being that is solidified, it's ossified, it's calcified. We were designed to change and to move and to progress, to evolve, to have many lives in which one life dies to another and gives rebirth to another life.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you. And it's also part of the Christian experience. And Christianity is replete with symbolisms and icons and stories and narratives of this dying to a self and this rebirth to a new self. And Mormonism, am I okay? Is the sound okay? And Mormonism wouldn't be the social drama that it is of dying to the old self. Mormon is because of the very notion of a community dying to oneself and reemerging as another. This is another form of reemergence that we're experiencing. And it's not my intention to reduce anybody's experience. It feels really lonely and isolating when you're going through it to the ordinary. I'm not saying that you're just kind of commonplace. It's not commonplace. It's a glorious experience to emerge into something else. It certainly doesn't feel like it when you're in the thick of transformation and you feel like there is nobody else there for you. It can be isolating, it can be disorienting, it can be lonely and confusing. You've come from a place of solidness. You are thrust out into this space, where we call it, that's the liminal space, it's threshold space, and there's nothing holding you. You're not certain where you're going to, you're not certain of where you'd come from, and it's this obviously the space that we're talking about today. And I want to map this in sociological terms, and Thomas is going to probably map it in some mystical term. And I'd like to provide a really broad template for understanding the social processes, because I think some of us are really concerned about what that means. Our biggest concern is not our transformation. Our biggest concern is the effect that it has on our community and on our families and the people around us. And will we make a difference? Will we be recognized in the institution that once held us if we decide to merge back into it? Now, in many communities, the rites of passage include three stages, as Thomas talked about: separation, initiation, and return. I think this is what you're saying when you talk about fusion, integration, discrimination, or whatever it was. I can't remember.
Write the words down.
I was listening. And so many communities do that. They birth these changes and these transformations. It could be that the community decides that isolation or silence and a period of self-sufficiency is necessary for transformation. I know in New Zealand we have various, we have an outward bound, where that is kind of a liminal space. People are put into moments of physical and emotional uncertainty. And the whole notion is that you'll come out of that as a more complete human being. These are kind of wilderness skills. That's why we take people into the wilderness. This is your period of transformation. This is your liminal space. You don't recognize yourself in this space, and that gives you the opportunity to reemerge as somebody else at the other end. And it happens that many cultures value this as a community ritual, as a way of initiating change and maturation. Now, the thing is that in Mormonism, we have those rites of passage as well. Baptism, ordination, repentance, the temple, this idea that you are going into a sacred space. We are involved, we're initiated into all of these rituals, and we have to come out new beings, cleansed from the blood and sin of the generations, reclothed, renamed. The mission is another liminal space. Well, it's intended to be a ritualized liminal space, being sealed, fasting. Even the sacrament reflects some attention to the need for us to be separated out for however long in order to grow into a better self, followed by a return to the community, endowed, washed clean, anointed, forgiven, or renewed. But sometimes the institution, even with its rites of passage and ritual, fails to generate transformation. Perhaps it's become ossified and hardened. Perhaps it's lost its stories and its imagination to give transcendent meaning to these rites of passage. Perhaps the element of love is missing from these rites and has become associated with compulsion or social expectations. So we seem hardwired to burst into new ways of being, and new ways are often created in liminal space. The experience of neither being here nor there, the feeling of being propelled out into space unclaimed by certainties. And in healthy communities, whatever gets created in liminal space is welcomed upon return. And I'm saying in healthy communities. We don't know how people are going to return having been in a threshold space, but we welcome whatever wisdom they come back with. We do that instinctively with our children, don't we? We allow them to leave. Well, most of us allow them to leave, and some of you feel like maybe you're the children of parents who haven't really allowed you to leave. You're still going back for Sunday dinners and whatever it is. But no. You allow them to leave. We look forward to seeing their new growth, their development when they come home. And Nathan and I have a 22-year-old, and we often smile at how wise our artistic musician hipster philosopher son is, who loves to wax lyrical about his latest inspirations as if none of what he has lit upon has ever occurred to us. And we make And we make space for that because it's kind of cool to watch your kids grow. And it's useful for us to help him build that muscle of growth so that he can bring wisdom when he's a parent. But the space isn't always made for that natural, soulful evolution in the church. And we know that. That's probably why we're here, right? The organization doesn't give that time to uncertainty. It often gets snuffed out in our interviews and our lessons and our meetings as soon as it gets expressed. I recall a couple of years ago I bore my testimony of unknowing. I thought I was being radical. I said, I can't say that I know anything, because how can anyone possibly know the length and the depth and the breadth of divine truth? But I choose to believe, and in choosing to believe, my life feels spiritually fuller, and I feel called to be a better human being. At which point, the male half of a senior missionary couple from Utah raced up to the podium, gesticulated violently, and I think he might have even slammed his hand on the podium, telling me, well, not telling me, telling everybody, but he's really telling me, that he knows and he's certain. And this was an obvious counterweight to my less than satisfactory testimony and was more than anything an expression of his own need for a single story of Mormonism. Do you have anything to say, Brother McConkie?
I do, but you're on a roll.
Okay. No, I'm going to hand it over to Thomas.
That's a great place to leave off, because there's something I want to talk about when we're looking at growth, when we're talking about development, when we're talking about evolution, death, resurrection, these deeply archetypal experiences in human life. We need to understand the resistance that naturally comes up to them. So this story, this image Gina offers us when she invokes the liminal and says, I just don't know. And the space of possibility that unfurls. And it happened to be a man, but I'm going to name it as the masculine need to know and to move towards clarity. It's that move on the pulpit when I know, right? Think about the rhetoric we hear in our own culture, right? What kind of rhetoric do you hear that strikes you as a defense against the liminal, a defense against dying, a defense against transition, right? You can shout it out if something comes to you. I'm thinking of a few phrases I hear often. Doubt your doubts. Don't doubt your faith. Doubt your doubts, right? Anything else come up?
With every fiber of my being.
Thank you. With every fiber of my being, absolutely. Stay in the boat. What could be a more anti-liminal injunction than that? Absolutely.
Hold to the rod.
Hold to the rod, absolutely. So as Gina was pointing out, this defense against liminality is built into institutions, not just the Mormon church. It's built into institutions. And it's built into us as individuals. How do we resist the liminal? So shift gears for a minute here and just feel into your own life. It might be this very moment. Yeah, a hand.
I can't do that, or that's too scary.
That's too scary, absolutely. Yeah. What else comes up? Yeah.
Currently, I find myself wanting to grasp onto labels, like the rest of Mormon, or
yeah,
transitioning, or faith places that other people relate to. And that makes me feel more safe with how unsure I am about everything.
Absolutely. Labels. Perfect. Please.
Living in your head.
I want to talk about that. To me, thinking, you know, most basically is the very most common way we defend against growth and liminality in our own personal lives. Absolutely. Anything else coming up? Yeah. Connie.
Fear of change and insecurity.
Of course. Fear of change, insecurity. Yeah. Anyone else? You're starting to feel this, right? Like you don't have to look far to notice your own resistances to liminality. We don't have to look far to notice institutional resistance. It's all around us, right? We had something here, Anthony?
Yeah, we feel a desperate need to reconcile the
Yes.
I spend tremendous amounts of time reading and studying.
Right.
Trying to get back.
Yep.
And with no.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and there's that move towards towards certitude again that Gina pointed out, right? Okay, beautiful. So one more. Yeah, please.
Trump being, trying to keep your family together.
Yeah.
Having that Trump over what you felt needed to do, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tender one, right? Absolutely. Yeah. Last one, then we'll move on, yeah. Sure.
And have the same feelings that we have.
Beautiful. And I would say that's a beautiful transition. To me, that feels more like how do we yield to liminality? And one way we do that is in community. We ritualize liminality. We face the death together. Right? So I would invite you guys, if you would trust me, to lead us a little bit deeper into liminality together as a community. Would you guys be willing to do that?
Yeah.
I'm hearing an emphatic yes over here. Can anybody top that emphatic yes? Yeah. I'd like to, how many people have done some mindfulness, just some really basic meditation? If I could, I'd just like to guide a really basic meditation where we can relax together, drop in, let go of our normal defenses, and see what this liminal moment as an individual and as a community wants to offer us. If we're willing to actually receive the power of liminality, what's here for us? And this is where, you know, I think Gina speaks really beautifully to this, that we don't know who we're going to be on the other side. We just trust going into the wormhole that there's something trustworthy about it. I love the Spanish poet Lorca's phrase. He talks about duende, which is a Spanish word that he coined. And he says, when you know duende, you've been baptized in the dark waters. So if I could ask you, Nathan, to just bring the lights down. It's an off switch right above your head. And here we are. So I'm just going to move back to my seat. I'd invite you to get comfortable in your seat. If you'd like to lay down and go Shavasana style, lie down on the floor, do whatever is comfortable, whatever you can kind of relax into and let go.
Yeah.
Don't be shy. So you can just start by bringing awareness deep into the body, into the flow of physical sensation. Feeling the support of the ground beneath you, the stability, the nourishment of the ground. And whatever your posture, see if you can just trust your body's weight even more deeply into the ground, just allowing yourself to be held, allowing yourself to let go and soften. Let awareness soak through your entire body the way water soaks through a sponge. Feeling all of the body in this moment, the way sensation flows, the way it's changing, the way the rise and fall of the breath fans sensation. And you can notice the flow of emotion through the body. Notice the tone of emotional energy. Just allowing it to flow through you. As naturally as the wind blows or the rain falls, emotion fills the body, colors this moment. See if you can let go even more, letting the body soften, letting the face become smooth. Trusting the space of unknowing. And you can be aware of thoughts in the mind floating through awareness with no need whatsoever to stop thought or tamp it down. You can allow thought to flow through awareness as naturally as blood flows through the veins. And in a place deeper than the body knows, deeper than the mind can fathom, you can let go into the stillness, the expanse of your own awareness. Clear and pristine. Returning to a place of utter simplicity, innocence. As you notice thoughts coming up in the mind, sensations in the body, sounds in the room, in the world around you, you can just notice the way awareness grabs hold of those moments, those experiences, and practice letting go again. Letting go into this space where you don't need to know. You simply are. And from this space, you can open up awareness to all the conditions of your life in this moment. Noticing particularly what's leaving you, what's dying, what has lived its life and is ready to be let go of. You don't have to think about this, you can just feel it, sense into it. Letting go of what's outworn, the way a tree sheds its leaves in the autumn. No need to spend any more energy holding on. And in this same moment, you can bring awareness to what's expansive in your life, what has a growing energy and momentum, is just born, just coming into being, something tender, something precious to you. And you can just allow this to expand. Allow it to be more fully present in your life. Allow yourself to stand into this being that you're becoming. As you're ready, you can slowly begin to open your eyes, staying soft, staying open, just allowing whatever this moment is to be what it is, trusting that something not you has the power, the wisdom to integrate it, to put it to service more fully in your life. Thank you. So I'd like to invite everybody to find someone to partner up with. It can be someone you know or someone you don't. And it's just an opportunity. I'll give you a few minutes each to just share whatever's coming up for you. If you feel comfortable sharing what you experienced just now, go for it. And if you don't feel comfortable, then just feel into what you'd like to share with your partner. So listen for the chimes. I'll give you 3 or 4 minutes each. And then we'll come back and see what kind of community we are now. I'll give you a minute to pair up. And Nathan, you can bring the house lights up too. Thank you so much. Is that good? Cool. Good. Chill out. Go ahead and begin. Yeah. So, yeah, let's... So I'm going to give them a few minutes of peace. People usually just keep this up. Their actions bring themselves forward. And then... What I would... My recommendation, I feel like the most natural move would be to, like, let people process, like, you know, I'd invite, like, the individual and just see what that does. And then I feel like that's a powerful history in the body, because it's like all of our individual transformation. Feeding into the mental. That's like just like then I think we're ready. Totally, no, anything you enjoy me is good for us. I'm great. Yeah, I mean, this is really cool too, to see how they start to work with it and turn it up. It was a little easier than I anticipated, like guidelines when you follow people. Crazy. Yeah, if you're in a meditation workshop, it's one thing to do. It's imposing. Take another 30 seconds and then we'll switch up. If you haven't switched turns yet, you can invite your other partner to share their experience. You have another 4 minutes. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, what I could like kind of harvest from it, if you're okay with that. That would give you plenty of time. I think you bring the community to harvest and just kind of check in with people. And then like you bring home and it's just kind of
one more minute. Go ahead and offer some gratitude to your partner, like I see some people already doing. You can say thanks. Yeah. Thank you so much, everybody, for trusting me to take us into that space and for doing your own work. Yeah, that was a really beautiful experience. This is a moment to just share anything that came up in the process. If you're willing to share with the big group now, anything that came up. Yeah, we'll just take a moment to check in with how everyone's doing. Yeah. Cliff.
Cody and I talked about the sort of...
Can everybody hear Cliff?
Cody and I talked about the difficulty of the integration, of what that might look like. That there might be a real resistance to what. So fusion, yeah, differentiation, yeah, but to come back and how to navigate that and what that would look like. I mean,
right. There's like a pressure there, right? How do I be a whole person? Yeah. Yeah. It's a process. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that. Anyone else? Yeah. Hands, please, over there. Yeah. Thank you. What was your name, sir?
Alan.
Alan, thank you. So let me just point out, and this is to kind of tie these two comments together. We're in a new place now, right? And we're still in liminal space, right? Life isn't just this process where like, ooh, it was liminal for a while. Now I know who I am, right? right? So all we did just now, it seemed like something really special. And, you know, I'm a showman, so I had Nathan bring the lights down, and I brought my Buddhist bells. But all we were really doing is noticing the fact that we're always liminal. We're always dying to something and leaving something behind, if only the previous moment. And we're always awakening to what's coming into our life. We just took a moment to ceremonialize that, to ritualize that, right? We don't have to be solved. We'll never be solved. Even as we integrate one thing, we're moving into deeper liminality and confusion in another space. So it's this process. Yeah, lots of hands. Let's go. Did I see one over here first? Did someone have their hand up? I want to be fair. Jolene. Grief.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. Yes. And that is the hallmark of the liminal space, that we're surprised by what we encounter, and sometimes we just need to feel something again before we really let it go. Yeah. Over here, please, in back, glasses. Yeah. Thank you so much. What's your name?
Lauren,
thank you. Just, I want to draw your awareness for the moment to just feeling the room, how raw it is in here, how tender it feels. Right? There's a reason we don't go to the liminal so readily, because we have to die to something. Sometimes it's dying to this notion like, oh, I'm fine. I let go of that. I'm over it. Right? Right? And we come into this place and we enter a deeper truth, and it's often very simple. It's like, oh, I'm in pain. It still hurts, right? It's really powerful to encounter that and offer it in community. Thank you. Yeah.
So I have this awareness of a fierce sense of vulnerability and fragility that was initially scary. But then as I sensed that and I was in a room full of vulnerable people, I felt empowered.
Yeah.
That I could be who I am.
Yeah.
And then it transitions to an awareness that we speak a different language now.
Yeah.
And if we go back and speak to someone that spoke our old language, it'd be like us speaking Chinese to someone who speaks Spanish.
Yeah.
And it's not that they don't want to speak our language, it's yeah. that they don't even know how.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Saw a hand over here. Please.
I love this sort of thing, and because I went to the one that Michael Ferguson did, because we already did that, I think it was like, whoosh, there I'm down deep. But the image for me when you were talking about shedding something that's dying, I would die first.
Thank you. I didn't get your name.
Monica.
Thank you, Monica. This is really beautiful to just feel the community coming together in its vulnerability, in its newness, right? Just by going where we did together and sharing our experience, it totally changes the shape of our experience in this moment together. Just a comment I'd like to leave you with. We can come back to this. I want to leave time. I want to pass it over to Gina here. But one thing I'll say is that when we're moving into the liminal, and your comments are reflecting this, that it's a process of becoming more of who we are and less of who we're not, right? So we feel a fear that we thought would destroy us, and then we encounter it, and this insight comes, oh, I'm actually bigger than this fear, right? So to just feel what this really transformative space, to be baptized in these dark waters, to really take that in, it's actually a gift to us. It allows us to become more of who we were meant to be. Yeah. So I'm going to turn it over to Gina for a moment, and then we'll open it back up to the group.
I'm really sensitive to where we're resting in our bodies and in our souls right now, and As I talk and do a little bit more theorizing, I want us to engage less with the brain and understand how the words that I offer you today feel. And I'm mindful when I was a undergraduate, I took a course in New Zealand politics, and the lecturer, we call them lecturers in New Zealand, was a man called Rob Stephen. He was just going through a divorce, so he was quite weepy, and in our tutorials, he would invite us to come to his office where we would sit on cushions and we would share. And, you know, I was a Māori girl. I still am. And I grew up in a nation that didn't give me many words, that didn't give me any history, that didn't give me any stories to make sense of why I was experienced as so problematic as a child. I went to kindergarten, and my mother had to equip me with the words racism as a four-year-old to understand why I got different treatment to the other children. I went to school, and I had to try and make sense of why it was that there was leniency for some children and their poor behavior, but as soon as I did anything really bad, all hell would break loose, and I cannot tell you how many times I ended up on the teacher's knee being spanked. And I'm sitting in, as a 19-year-old, in Rob Stephen's New Zealand politics class, and he gives me a history. He tells me for the first time that my ancestors had their land stolen. He tells me for the first time that my ancestors had their language taken. And that's why I don't speak it, and that's why my father doesn't speak it, and that's why my grandfather encouraged his children only to speak English because they were punished for speaking their language. He tells me, he gives me the language for the first time, colonization. And he lays out, he opens up the map and says, this is what happened in your past. This is the effects that this has on successive generations. And at that point, I didn't just feel it in my head, I felt it in my heart, and it was a release. I could stop blaming myself because there was something bigger happening around me and because of me and with me and in response to me. I could stop holding that in myself. And so I offer these words today, not as a sociologist so that you hold it in your head and take notes, but that you hold it somewhere, that it offers perhaps a release, a way of understanding some words, and this is often what we don't have, particularly in the church, words to make sense of what we're feeling. Now, I left talking about the intractability of the church, and I feel that there's a lot of questions coming up about what does this mean now when I go back to church? How can I bring this new me to this space? So I just want to just be patient with me as I work through some theory. Part of the reason for the intractability that each of us feels in church is, as Victor Turner, he's an anthropologist, calls it, the heavyweight of hierarchy. He calls this structure, and there are two words that I would like you to remember, structure. So I've only got two. I'm easier on you than Thomas is. First word, structure. Structure, or institutions that become fossilized. They've lost their moral compass. They've become secularized, or their immoral imagination is put into shadow because of the need for social control or corporate efficiencies. When an institution or a structure becomes antithetical or even hostile to the free expression and exploration of ideas, to dialogical relationships. And when I mean dialogical relationships, I want to share a story of my stake president and I. We had this wonderful relationship. He called me into his office and he said to me, "I'm really concerned." This was around Christmas time. "I'm really concerned about some of the things that you've been writing. Your podcasts are fine. I like the one with Thomas McConkie. But but what you're writing is really upsetting." And what he was saying actually is that he'd been given the nod or the direction from area office to pull me into line. And I sat and listened to him for a little while, and I said, probably full hardly, "Jared," so I never call him president. "Jared, you seem really afraid of something. You want to tell me what it is?"
Liminality.
He was pretty white-knuckled about that, and he didn't respond. But Nathan, who was with me in the meeting, he said, "I'm not sure why we're here. How about this? How about you go away and look at what she's written and write down point by point what the problem is, and then we can come back to a conversation about that." And he seemed to accept that. And I said, "I'm willing to have a conversation with you, but let's have a dialogue. I'm willing to change because of something that you said, as long as you're willing to change because of something that I said. I would like a dialogue with you." He hasn't asked me back. So often our churches are fossilized, they're ossified to this notion of dialogical relationships, this idea of moving a conversation through us and seeing what comes out at the other end. And it emphasizes often, first and foremost, the need for homogeneity and compliance. Or when a breach happens, this will give rise, or compliance. And when a breach happens, this will give rise to this spontaneous evacuation of some of its adherents into liminal space, into threshold space, as I think that most of us here have experienced or are experiencing. And it's in this space that we find each other. And so when you talk about what happens next, we start finding each other. Turner calls this communitas. We, in this space, are communitas. I found Aubrey last month, and we just had this wonderful connection. She's one of my wonderful discoveries in communitas, and we're here at Sunstone. There will be people that we will hug and hold. There will be people that we weep with. They are our communitas. And so there is a good thing that happens in threshold space, and that is the people that we meet there. Remarkably, though, that we mostly assemble in cyberspace, our concerns about the structure are all quite similar. We're concerned about they, the magisterium, and their heavy-handed management of the structure. So we naturally opt in communitas, and Victor Turner says this happens across most threshold spaces. This is characteristic. We opt for flat structures, for equal status, no leadership. We assume we have this heightened sense of intimacy with each other. The Jesus movement was a communitas. And it happened on the heels of the rigidity of this pharisaical control of Judaism and its allegiance with the Roman Empire. Out of that period emerged the Essenes, the Nazarenes, John the Baptist, and once again the Jesus movement, where typically what they said was that they eschewed central and secularized control by the structure and sought transcendent utopian ways of being with each other. So two words, structure and communitas. We come out of structure into communitas, we find each other. So it's not an isolated experience, and it makes it easier in this world of technological, social media to find each other. Mormonism was one such communitas. Under Joseph Smith, the Mormon communitas was formed out of this deliberate separation from mainline religions, largely with some of the complaints that we have today about our own church. All of this gives rise to deeper spiritual expressions. It gives rise to new texts and new mythologies and divine imagination. And in this charismatic led organization of the early church emerged new organizational ideas such as the United Order. And in these paroxysms of intimacy, they started peer bonding and multi-bonding and forming families in new and innovative and creative ways. So it's not all, peaches and cream and the communitas. It can get a bit weird. All of these are innovative possibilities, and these new ways of being, the emergence of new stories, the extemporaneous burgeoning of new forms of spiritual power and influence arises. That's something that we can embrace and think about and sit with and enjoy. It is pregnant with possibility. Mm. It's also in this liminal communitas that the woman church, as Rosemary Reuther calls it, emerges, where specific attention is consecrated to the needs of women. And we see in our communitas now different iterations of attention to women. We're discussing more than I've ever seen before the idea of the divine feminine. We have feminist Mormon housewives. We have ordained women. We have a concerted effort to pay attention to the feminine. But staying in communitas and in liminal space is always temporary. I think it was St. Francis that wanted to stay in communitas, but his followers decided that they wanted to have something a little bit more structured, so they organized themselves. And this is what we do. That's why how the Mormons became problematic for us today, because nobody stays in communitas or liminal space. There's always a need to do something, to return, to go elsewhere, or to integrate. Some will want to return from communitas to a structure with their new ideas, their fresh new ideas, their paradigms, and they do this with the intention to influence, to enliven and enrich it, the structure, and bring hope to it. And you can see now how, in the movement of organizations, this is always happening. People pop out, they form new communities, ways of thinking, ways of being, new narratives. They return, they enrich and enliven. And if they do that in enough numbers, the organization must respond. And eventually it will happen again, and people will pop out. It won't be good enough, and they will pop out again. They will create, they will exercise divine spiritual imagination, and they will come back in. Some people don't do this. Some people go their separate ways. They don't return. Either way, communitas, this spontaneous and really effervescent flowering in this gorgeous transcendent intimacy with others who want better for the world will always be with us, as will the structure. As long as structures and institutions are with us, communitas will always appear. Thomas, do you have anything?
Thank you so much, Gina. That was beautiful. I just have a few words that are present for me right now, then I'd love to open up to all the participants this afternoon. In my own words, the liminal space can be very frightening. It can be very messy. It can be very weird, as Gina pointed out. And it is also profoundly trustworthy. Right? It is the formless womb of everything that's new coming through this world navel and into manifestation. And what you discover in liminality is a gift to yourself and a gift to this community. And I celebrate this liminal moment with everybody. And it's such a pleasure to be here at Sunstone, this liminal symposium in liminal times with everybody. Thank you. Yeah.
We're going to go ahead and take any questions that you might have. You're welcome to come up to the podium and ask. We ask you to keep them brief and be considerate of others who might also have questions. And we have about 16 minutes.
Adrian.
So I realize that it's fear in part.
Will you come up?
Nobody else
has noticed. Thomas, that's
on the recording.
She wants it on the recording. I can repeat the question if you'd like, and you can sit down.
Okay. So I know part of it's fear about the liminal.
Now you're just in liminal space. What are you gonna do?
I know part of it's fear for the liminal, but my other question is, it's not just fear. I feel like obligated to stay at the grave of the dying. Mm-hmm. Like, it's disloyal to leave. So how do I step over the threshold?
Yeah. Do you care if I jump on that?
Go jump on it, Thomas.
So what that brings up for me, Adrian, is that as an idea, you say, feel like I need to stand over the grave of the dying, you can move into your own liminal space and see if that's true now. And then see if it's true now. Because there's going to be a moment at which it's not true anymore and it's time to stop dying and there's something new coming into your life. So I'd say as long as it's true that you need to honor the dead and the dying, I would honor them fully. And when your own intelligence and your own wisdom and intuition tells you it's time to not, time to move on, that you'll know that too. Yeah.
I don't have to wait till my in-laws are dead.
Not enough information to answer that question at this time. Yeah, please.
Hey, take this, take this.
My question is about, I love the imagery and the concept of the death and then the rebirth. I really like that. And I feel like, you know, once again, that's a long process sometimes, and sometimes it's a quick one. The question I have for both of you is, what's the power, we use the term, I'm going to take a vacation from the institution. What's the power and what's the timing and what's the benefits of the vacation?
As someone who has taken a vacation, I think that there needs to be some reassurance that leaving, however leave-taking is experienced or enacted. It could be a physical sabbatical. It could be that we sit in disagreement with those at church. That's a kind of a leave-taking as well. It's all natural and necessary. In terms of timing, I think that your body knows. And Thomas and I often talk about the yes-no praxis, the wisdom of our bodies. What is our body saying to us? If our body is seizing up in resistance to being in that space, then our body's telling us, take a rest. Don't go today. Don't go. And then you just monitor that every week. And if that turns into years, that's fine. But honor and respect what your body is telling you.
Earlier, I think it was Eugenia mentioned or talked about the choice to believe. What would you say, and either or both of you can answer this question, but what advice would you give someone who doesn't believe but wants to believe and they're in that liminal space? Why would they choose to believe? And what would you say to them that might get them to the space where they do believe?
Okay, hold on, Nathan, can I just ask?
Yeah.
Nathan, what do you mean when you say, this is my husband, so this could get tricky. What do you mean when you say believe? What does belief mean to you?
Those things which I guess are principles upon which you make decisions in your life because you believe them to be right, good, true, efficacious.
Okay. So they're propositions for and values?
Yep, could be.
Okay. Mm. So if somebody wouldn't believe, chooses not to believe that. You want to get them into a position to believe that. It would suggest that if they don't believe it, they don't think it's good or right for their lives.
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay. So the question is, how do you make somebody believe or choose to believe that something is good and right for their life?
Well, why would they? Let's say...
Told you it could get tricky.
Let's take it in terms of belief in yeah. God. Because I would say that for most of us here today, God has brought us here. You know, in some way, shape, or form, it is God that has led us to this place. So what if you've gotten to a place in your faith transition or your faith crisis where you don't know or you don't believe necessarily in God, but you actually want to?
Okay.
Can I offer something and then anything coming up for you? But I really hear and feel that question, Nathan. And to me, it's a perfect example of liminality where we've grown up believing, right? And then we come to a point where belief is what's dying. And in my experience, that liminality, that baptism in dark waters, it's the coming into a new self that is not organized around belief so much as something that we couldn't have even imagined before we started to leave belief behind. And that's an incredibly painful metamorphosis to lose our beliefs. And in my experience, it's also a really trustworthy process. Who are we when it's not our beliefs that we use to orient, but it's a deeper knowing, a deeper intuition about what's true and what's so? Yeah, that's what comes up for me.
And what's coming up for me, Nathan? When you talk about belief in God, the question that I would have is it always bad that the God that we once believed in has died? Because perhaps the God that we believed in is not productive for us anymore, and that we need to lay to rest the God of before and allow. And as Thomas suggested, there's an intelligence to way, I mean, I believe in an intelligence in the universe and the way that we are in the universe, and that when we allow something to pass away naturally, that something, that there is enough generosity in the universe that something else will emerge. And, you know, for some of us, for me, I've had to let the patriarchal God of Mormonism, the anthropomorphic kind of, you know, penis-wielding God of Mormonism, give way to something far more feminine and far more generous and far more able to understand me as a woman. So not all dying of belief in God is something tragic that you need to call people back to. But if you let the process happen, trust that the universe is generous enough to provide another form of believing, if that's what is good for that soul.
Nice. Thanks, Nathan.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, I just want to tag on to that. I'm thinking of St. John of the Cross in this moment. And St. John of the Cross, a Catholic monk from centuries back, he described what he called the night of sense. And he described that it's not God who's dying. It's our younger relationship with God, our childish notions that don't serve us anymore. And, you know, in his own personal mystical encounters, he testified that there's something beyond belief, beyond our wildest imaginings, that's coming in more fully into our lives. Mm. Yeah.
John.
Hi. So in the second podcast that you guys did together, Thomas, you started with a story about driving on the freeway here in Utah and kind of reconciling with your parents.
Yeah.
And it was really powerful. And I wonder if you could expand on that, because I think that moment holds a lot of answers for the pain that people are feeling. And trying to get along despite disagreements.
Yeah. Thanks, John. Anything specifically you'd like me to speak to? Or?
Well, just maybe expand more on that. Like, how do we get there? You said that you got there in that moment when you were driving, and that you had this reconciliation. So how do we nurture that? How do we, there's a lot of power there, but how do we access that power?
Cool. Yeah, I'll try in the space of 60 seconds so we can get to some other questions. And I'd love to talk to you more about that. So for those of you who didn't hear that particular conversation with me and Gina, I was sharing a story about how I was driving along one day. It's about 8 years ago. And I felt a profound forgiveness come over me. You know, I realized that the hurt that I'd felt from the church and the hurt that I felt from my parents, it wasn't actually them hurting me, but it was just pain itself rippling across the generations. So I went from this place of feeling like I was owed something, right? To a place where I felt incredible compassion for my parents and for my parents' parents and for their parents' parents and all the way back to the rocks. I just sensed us all on this human stage struggling and flailing and doing everything we know how to release this pain, to purify it and to not pass it on. So in the context of this session, of this community gathering here right now, to me, what invites that is relaxing. Like as simple as starting with a relaxed body so we can feel what our body's telling us. And then opening our hearts and actually trusting that we can be present to the moment and we can be guided. And then opening our will to whatever's coming into our life. And when we really do that, when we open our minds, our hearts, our will, something huge comes in that we're hardly ready for. Right? But it's available. Right? It's not 10 years down the road when you have that lucky moment too. It's right here. It's an open invitation. It's the most generous invitation we can imagine that comes from, I don't know what else to call it but God. Right? But it's this invitation to share that divinity. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you, John. Yeah, we'll talk more.
So a question I have is...
Speaking of the mic.
Oh, yeah. So
you.
The question I have is, I'll give a really brief my experience. So I had a lot of these issues 20 years ago, and the culture is such that I got frozen, right? And I've been frozen for 20 years, and I mean, one of the ways I got frozen is I felt like I was a Mormon avatar on the outside, an atheist in the inside. And then I was frozen. I was doing my own thing. And I came up and I realized this community existed, which helps me a lot. But the question I have is, I know there's a lot of pain out there still. I still have a hard time finding community. How do we find a community that's, I know I've listened to a lot of podcasts, but how do we find a community that's where we're not fighting? I feel like I'm fighting this very big divide. It's where, you know, we're lots of people, I feel like, are blindsided on one side and then blindsided on the other. Yeah. So that's my question. How do we find the in-between space for each other? It's really difficult.
Sorry, what's your name?
Sterling.
Sterling.
Yeah.
Your question. Hold on. Come back, Sterling.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm trying to run away.
So it sounds like your question is what to do in this space, or what to find, or where to go.
Where to find community in this space, because it's so tumultuous. Yeah.
Communitas is that.
What's that?
That is what communitas is.
Yeah.
That's what we're wrestling with.
Yeah, well, again, but my question is, at least in my experience, I feel like I got frozen. There wasn't a place to go when I originally experienced this.
So are you saying that you're looking for peace?
I'm finding it now, but what I'm saying is just, I feel like I spent 15 years frozen. right? Getting nowhere. I was in Hades, for a better word, right, with this issue, because there was no resolution that I could find. Yeah.
Right. Thomas?
Yeah.
All right, have I got this? Steve?
Talk to John Huber.
Yeah. No.
The community of Christ is reinventing itself now.
I've got
yeah.
yeah. You got it after me. Yeah.
Feeling like what you are, what we are.
Yeah.
And they're coming together.
Okay.
And he's here.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Steve. Can I just interject with something that I found really valuable from Richard Rohr? He calls the church a crucible. And he says, church doctrine, theology, and morality force all issues to an inner boiling point where you are forced to face issues at a deeper level to survive. Before the truth sets you free, it tends to make you miserable. So I suppose in the spirit of what we're saying is to allow that misery, unfreeze from it, allow the misery,
yeah.
and just see what happens. It's that's what threshold space, that's what we're talking about, threshold space,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was, hello, oh, I lost it. Yeah, beautiful, Gina. I think it was Krishnamurti who talked about the flame of discontent. You know, as you go deeper and deeper into your own discontent, it is going to burn your ass, and it's going to get you up finding a community like this that will meet you and will love you.
Yeah.
I love you.
Thank you,
I love you too.
Thank you, Sterling.
Thank you so much. This has been amazing. I wanted to say one thing that I thought about during the guided meditation. I don't know if it's part of our culture or part of my personality to feel like I need to justify myself and to explain and to apologize. And I think part of his question that came to my mind was that I don't think we need to apologize for the space that we're currently occupying. Like, if you're in an angry place, you don't need to justify it to anyone. If you're in a sad place or a place where you can't let go and you can't leave yet, I feel like we need to just live there for a little bit, right? And we don't have to tell anybody why or explain it or say, like, well, I think this, but I still believe in the church, or there's still some good things happening, right? We always have the rebuttal statement, like, well, this is what I'm dealing with, but this is all good too. I do that all the time, not just with this transition, but just in life, that I feel like I have to justify everything I do. And I think this was a really wonderful opportunity for me to realize that I don't have to apologize or explain myself. So thank you. And thank you all for coming to 274. This was amazing. And we have to clear out the space so that they can start the next session. So thank you.